Hi, it's Jamie, Progressive number one, number two employee. Leave a message at the...
Hey, Jamie, it's me, Jamie. This is your daily pep talk. I know it's been rough going ever since people found out about your a cappella group, Mad Harmony, but you will bounce back. I mean, you're the guy always helping people find coverage options with the Name Your Price tool. It should be you giving me the pep talk. Now get out there, hit that high note, and take Mad Harmony all the way to nationals this year! Sorry, it's pitchy.
Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
You are Locked On Thunder, your daily podcast on the Oklahoma City Thunder. Part of the Locked On Podcast Network. Your team, every day.
Hello there, everyone. We're locked in for episode 207 of Locked On Thunder, presented by the Norman Transcript. I'm your host, Fred Katz. Locked On Thunder is part of the Locked On Podcast Network. Head out to iTunes, search Locked On Thunder, subscribe to the podcast there, and leave a review once you're on that page. Find us on audioboom.com, and you can log on to normantranscript.com. Check out my blog, Thunder Road. It's under the sports tab on the site. You can see all my Thunder coverage there. I'm on Tuesdays and Thursdays now. I'm going to be moving back to more times a week, 3 days, 4 days, 5 days, something like that. Probably next week as we ramp up for draft coverage and all that kind of stuff and Russell Westbrook MVP stuff and free agency and summer league and all that stuff. So I'll be on more. For now, though, I'm making up for it in quantity when I'm going. So I have a ton of guests today. It's kind of a facsimile of I'm stealing what the last week's Down to Dunk episode was. So first guest, because we're going alphabetical order, is Andrew Schleck from Down to Dunk. Andrew, what's up?
Hello. Thanks for having me.
No, thank you. Thank you for coming. Next up, we got John Hamm.
Which alphabet are you using, by the way?
I'm going first name.
Oh, okay. And, all right, and, if you want to be like that.
And last, because R comes after J, comes after A, is Royce Young.
What's up? I guess me and Hambone here are pushing. This is a push.
Yeah, we are.
I have no idea.
We're
going to
be shoving here soon.
I have no idea what you're referring to.
Like our appearances.
Yeah. No,
Ham's Thunder appearances.
Royce, Ham's got you by like a couple of shows now.
I know. That's why I'm making no ground here.
Oh, you're pushing. I see. See, I'm stupid, so I don't understand these things.
Yeah. Well. Yeah. We know, Fred. We know.
CC Josh Huestis.
Yeah. Well, he's still crawling into my mentions. He crawled into my mentions today. Why do people think that reporters work for the teams that they're covering?
You know, one of my biggest pet peeves in the world, Fred, is like when somebody will like every now and then I'll have like a friend or something or even somebody maybe I hate to say this because this sounds so pretentious, but like somebody might recognize me or something, and they'll say, ooh, "Hey, yeah, you write for the Thunder." And it's like one of my biggest pet peeves in the world when they say, "You write for the Thunder." Like, no, I don't write for the Thunder.
If you guys weren't such homers, then I think people might be able to discover the truth. But you know, it's hard to see through that.
Sometimes I would like – I almost feel like we should have Homer Week. And, like, I'll show somebody what a homer looks like.
Just come on the Down to Dunk podcast. That's what we do constantly.
Andrew, we can have Samaje Christen Week for you.
That can coincide with
Homer Week.
You might have to put me in a straitjacket.
Yeah. so let's talk about Enes Kanter for a little bit, because that's I did a pod on Thursday previewing the NBA Finals. Before that, I did an all Kanter pod. I think that was Ham. Was that with you?
Yes,
all these
it was.
Days are the same. There we go. So
and it was brilliant, by the way.
If there's a podcast out there, John Hamm was on it, so just to make that assumption.
I actually do need to correct a fact error that John Hamm said on that podcast. When we were talking about David Holt, John Hamm dropped that he was running for governor, and I just kind of blindly agreed because John Hamm is right about everything. And then I realized after when my editor jokingly texted me after it and reminded me he's not running for governor, he's running for mayor of Oklahoma City.
Wait, didn't I say mayor?
He said governor.
Are you sure I didn't say mayor?
Because John Hamm is never wrong.
I am like pretty certain you said governor, and I'm not gonna fact check it. I'm just gonna blame you regardless.
I meant mayor, and you knew what I meant.
Ham is going to go back and change this a la Chad Ford.
I need a written statement from you, John Ham, that where you apologize. All you got to hope for is that some aggregator out there doesn't pick it up and try to ruin your day.
Well, so I needed to just make sure to discredit Ham before we got into more Kanter talk today. But we do need to talk a little bit about Kanter from the events over the weekend where his father was arrested and was supposed to have a court date on Monday. And Eric Horn was the first guy to report that court date was moved back now to Thursday, which is something that Erdogan will typically do. One of the human rights violations that they have there, according to Amnesty International, is that they basically push back the right to a speedy trial. You can be jailed for like up to, I think it's 30 days, according to that, without actually having a speedy trial. So, I mean, Royce, where do you see this going with Kanter?
I have no idea.
We've dove into like Turkish politics. Where do you see this going with his family?
It's going to get worse before it gets better. I would fully assume, right? I mean, this isn't. That to me, Fred, that's the scary thing is that I don't think anybody really has a good idea of where this is going to go. And I mean, I don't know enough about the international law and the geopolitical implications here, but do we even really technically know? I mean, we know why he was arrested. Do we know what he was charged for specifically? And like what that?
We don't. We don't.
Do we know that?
No.
So like to me, that's what makes it scary, And I know Innes, claimed that there would be torture involved or whatever. I don't know. And that the unknowns to me is what makes this kind of a terrifying situation here. And however long that Innes's father ends up, I think the thing to think about, Fred, is that this is not the last thing that's going to happen here. This is just another step in the process for whatever the Turkish government's trying to do.
It's amazing how quickly story is developing. Sorry, Andrew. It's amazing how quickly this story is developing. Like there seems to be a new thing every 2 days, right?
Yeah, and Innes seems to be fighting more for the movement than he is like specifically for his family. He's like, yeah, my dad is like one of like thousands of people,
which I think is a smart way to probably approach it, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I think Innes could get really emotional
as a voice, and so I think this goes to prove though what a lot of people's assumption was last year, right? That the family disowning Innes was, a strategic move on behalf of the family to try to create some distance there. And I think that this all kind of confirms that.
Mm-hmm. Well, Innes basically admitted that when he had that conference call on Friday night,
right.
he pretty much said, yeah, it was a political move, which I was surprised was something that he said, because that kind of defeats the purpose of the strategy. Right. I mean, it's pretty easy to figure out. Even at the time, it was pretty easy to put the dots together and realize that was the case. But still, I was surprised that he admitted something like that. Ham or any of you guys, was there anything that he said on Friday that you thought particularly stood out from when he did that conference call?
Well, Fred, you and I have talked about how Innes really needed to tone down some of the criticism, and at least kind of what I picked up, it looks like maybe that's taking place a little bit. And probably something that needs to continue, because I mean, he's obviously in a position to bring a great deal of awareness to what's going on over there and what's affecting not just his father, but so many other people. But, I'll get political for a moment. Don't trump it. Like there's a certain way to handle this in order.
Trumpet?
To,
is that one word? Race.
Yeah. Yeah. With an I at the end.
Okay.
So yeah.
Don't play the trumpet.
I think there's he's got to be a little bit more diplomatic about this.
Yeah, I think this is a situation where the loudest voice in the room is maybe not going to necessarily win. I do understand kind of where Innes is coming from, and making big bold rash statements is kind of what I think we all know Innes pretty well, and that he's not necessarily always the most rational person. You know, there's a maturity question when it comes to Enes Kanter. So I don't know that he's, you know, doing this in a really strategic manner. Like he's thinking like, okay, this is the best way to do it. But at the same time, you know, I think that he is obviously approaching this as like, you know, I want to say what I can say about this, because that's the whole point, is that, you know, you can't go jail my father just because I called you the Hitler of our century. And I think that's probably part of the point that Enes is driving at, is that, you know, we want the right to say, you know, we want the right to be able to say what we can. And the fact that the Turkish government's jailed his family, or trying to, it jailed his father and the rest of his family based on just words, I think is kind of like Enes's whole point.
Yeah, is he really dialing it back, though? Do you think he's dialing it back? Because, I mean, that tweet that came out just on the second said had that the Hitler of our century in it. Right. I don't feel like I don't know that he is being more diplomatic.
I guess the statement was what, to me, was – statement was – but obviously Enes probably had quite a bit of help on that one.
Sure.
Right. But that's kind of my point. Like, that's how – you know, you can – there's ways that you can, you know, look down upon that. But he's going to have to be a little bit more diplomatic about this. Or, like you said, it could get a whole lot worse before it gets better.
Right, and to be clear, we're not necessarily talking about the contents. Like, I think we're all for if he believes it's something that he wants to do and it's a cause that he believes in. I think I know I can say this for John specifically, because we have had this specific discussion on this podcast, and I think you guys would agree with me. Correct me if I'm wrong. If he believes, I mean, he talks about wanting to give a voice to the voiceless. And to me, the part that stood out the most, kind of, I thought it was a really powerful moment when I asked him on that conference call, is your father getting jailed? Is that something that's going to change the way that you speak out against Erdogan, the way that you talk about politics? Are you going to change anything? And he answered no. And Andrew, you already mentioned this answer already. You know, he said, my father is only one, and there are thousands of people who are unjustly in jail, and I need to speak for all those people. My father is just one person, and it's hard because he's my father, but it's one person versus thousands of people that I have to think about. And I thought that's hard to do. That's an admirable answer, and that's the approach that he wants to take. I think that people who know him should support that, because standing up for standing up against injustices is hard to do. And if you're educated enough to do it, and you have the platform to do it, and you're smart enough to do it, then it's something that I think deserves praise for doing, because it's just an emotionally and intellectually really difficult thing to do. But that being said, the calling him Hitler, the heckling, the calling people cowards, that kind of stuff, the trash talk, like, you're not playing the Warriors right now. You know, the trash talk has actual consequences, and it's this was something, John, that we didn't even talk about, the arrest of family members and that kind of stuff. We're still living in Turkey. We talked about it more in reference of, you know, safety within the U.S. There could be somebody who supports the current Turkish government who's living in the U.S. to, you know, it takes one crazy person to make a difference in Kanter's life, or somebody close to Kanter, or somebody who's just physically around Kanter who becomes collateral damage. And that's something that could be a problem. So I do think since the statement, I do think that was kind of a marker, because that's the first time he has really sent out a prepared statement and not necessarily spoken on the cuff. And I do think he was a little bit more in control, a little bit more diligent when we were on that conference call. He made a couple of jokes, but it wasn't quite at the expense of anything. Because I don't think I think we can now officially say there is no scenario in which Enes Kanter can lose his sense of humor. Like, he was making jokes about women proposing to him and wanting to marry him so he could become a U.S. citizen, and laughing about that. Yeah. But I don't know. Andrew, do you agree with that take?
Yeah. I mean, he's just in a tough place now. And I think that if he stops, then it's almost like the Turkish government has won, kind of, in his mind, probably. And so he obviously can't let that happen. It's something he's very passionate about, and I think that he deserves some support in this, but it's going to be a long road. It's going to be a really difficult road. What he's chosen to do is something that's going to have major consequences at some point and in some way, and I don't know if it's going to be in particularly just him, or if it's going to be only to like his immediate family members, but whatever it is, that it's going to be, it's a really big deal.
And I am going to plug something. I'm going to plug, guys, because this is my podcast. It's my podcast. I'm plugging. My editor, Caleb Slickard, wrote a piece on U.S.-Turkey kind of relations and how this Canner deal kind of underscores a lot of the tensions in relations between the U.S. and Turkey. And I contribute to that piece a little bit, and Caleb mostly wrote it. And it's a really interesting piece. I think he did a really good job with it, and it's worth reading for background. If you're into politics and you don't know that much about, you know, what's going on in Turkey, how it involves the U.S. and what's going on with Canner, I think it's a really interesting read and a good quick way to educate yourself on that whole situation of what's going on in Turkey and how it actually relates to the country that we, although not all my listeners live in the U.S., but the country that at least the four people that are talking on this podcast right now listen are live in. Does anybody else have anything you guys want to add on this topic before we move on?
Not really.
No. Nothing. John Hamm, tell me about Jackie Mack's article on KD.
Oh, I mean, look, it's Jackie Mack. I mean, she could write about, you know, the history of yak hair, and you'd have to read it, right?
She's the best.
So, yeah, an article that came out that basically, I mean, kind of with the backdrop of, you know, Kevin Durant thought his season was going to be over. And I'm talking about this past season. It almost came to an end in Washington, and it harkened back to obviously what Barry Trammell plagued or termed the plagues of Egypt season back in 14-15 when Kevin Durant missed a significant chunk of the season with the foot injury, and sort of how from there, you know, Kevin kind of got out and experienced the world in ways that maybe he hadn't before. And so, I mean, to me, I thought, you know, that's okay. I can relate to that. And that's probably something KD's PR team should have got out there earlier rather than a Russell Westbrook hit piece after he made that decision. But on the other hand, I mean, I'm kind of reading this and I'm like, is this Reba McEntire's? Is there life out there? I mean, was he that sheltered when he was on the road?
What was he doing in August and September every year?
Yeah. That's the part that kind of, that I didn't quite understand. I mean, it was kind of pumped up like his life was entirely basketball, no matter what. And then he had this foot injury, and then he went to Montreal and saw that there's people that spoke French and decided that, oh, I need to get and experience the world more. So I don't know. Fascinating. That's the highlight. Please go read the article. It's worth your time.
What I found interesting about it, especially, is I thought it was kind of an angle that, you know, obviously hasn't been all that explored with Durant's decision. And I think, though, that, you know, while I think, you know, I kind of laughed at it too, John, that, like, you know, it took, you know, going up to Montreal with, you know, Drake or whatever that was. And, you know, what are you doing in August and September? You're not going on vacations, you know. But I do think it kind of does speak to the fact that, you know, Kevin was really isolated in Oklahoma City, and that was kind of the mentality that he had here. That was part of the culture that he built here himself, was that it was like basketball first, you know, life second. And, you know, you almost competed against your own existing teammates kind of to see who could practice more. And, like, you know, that was kind of the charm of Oklahoma City. And, you know, Durant himself championed that often. Talking about how that's one of my favorite things about Oklahoma City. You know, if you go back and you can find Durant quote after Durant quote, him talking about his connection to Oklahoma City and how it's a perfect fit for him because he, you know, he can focus on basketball and you know, there's not a whole lot else to do, and that's like his passion. That's what he wants to do. So I do think that I do understand kind of the idea of that, like, when basketball was taken away from him, it expanded his horizons. And, you know, I think the Montreal thing was just kind of an example of that. And, you know, I actually talked to Jackie. I helped Jackie a little bit with the story with some background stuff. And one of the things that she told me on the phone is just the way that the story kind of came to be was just like a casual conversation she was having with Kevin at a game. And he kind of mentioned it. And then all of a sudden she just kind of thought, that's interesting. So, like, you know, it is kind of funny, John, to think that, like, you know, this is part of, I think, the kind of, like, everybody's trying to still kind of grasp and understand exactly the thought process and the things that went into Durant's decision. And when, you know, whoever it was, whether it was, you know, Kevin's agent, manager, you know, whoever that he had helping him with kind of the decision and the messaging after it, where it really kind of comes down to is the best messenger for this is Kevin himself when he's just being candid. And that's kind of what happened. And, you know, this, to me, this was a pretty insightful look into, like, kind of helping and kind of grasping his thought process and making the choice that he did.
And while I'm reading this article, I hear Kelly Clarkson's Breakaway playing in the background. I mean, it sounds It sounds just like, and then I come to find out that there's a lot of Kelly Clarkson songs that relate to the Thunder, if you really sit down and think about it. So when you have some time, I encourage you to do that.
Okay. So start listening. So I got to start listening to Kelly Clarkson's. How does Breakaway even go? Which one's that one?
I don't know that song.
Take a na, 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 na. How does that one go?
Go listen to it. I could not do it.
We want you to sing, Ham.
Breakaway. Is it that one? Is that right?
Yes. Yes. Yeah. I'll spread my wings and I'll learn how to fly.
Learn how to fly. Yeah.
Also, like the Thunder, Kelly Clarkson's way past her prime right now.
Oh, shush. Leave Kelly alone.
Ham spent way too much time looking behind those hazel eyes.
I mean, since you've been gone, that's
Russ's song.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Here's the thing. Start it out, friend.
I feel like Russ would like Pitch Perfect. He seems like he'd be a Pitch Perfect fan.
Oh, he is.
I kind of think like KD's song to Sam Presti would be Mr. Know-It-All, right?
Well, now we're getting into the deep cuts here. I know two Kelly Clarksons.
We are in the weeds of Kelly Clarkson. I don't know what y'all are talking about.
You've been deprived, Mr. Young.
Ham, I got a question for you.
Okay.
All right. Every single NBA publication, ESPN, and CBS and Slam and like does everything. Everyone is fired and there's an expansion draft and you're drafting NBA feature writers. Where is Jack McMullen's stock in that draft? Like, where does she go?
Oh,
NBA feature writers.
Man. It's kind of like, you know, her and Lee Jenkins, right?
Yeah, I'm cool. And like Chris Ballard, like those are the first
Ballard,
three picks?
Yeah.
Are those the first? Yeah. Royce, who else is there? Are those the first
three picks? Here's the shame of his growing fame is I fear that we're going to hear less from him because to me he was on just a track to be one of the finest NBA feature writers that we know. No, and he already is, but Pablo is fantastic. And the problem with Pablo now becoming a superstar at ESPN is he's going to be doing shows and he's doing TV and radio. And I don't know how much, I don't know how many more features he's got in him, but I put Pablo up there.
It's good. Andrew, who else is in there?
I don't know. It's a pretty good list of like the top people. I'd put Royce Young in there.
I was going to say, you know, when's somebody going to just go ahead and say my name? I thought I was going to have to say it myself.
I was kind of leaving the door open for you there, Royce. I mean,
man,
your own horn.
God. I thought that's what this whole thing. I thought that's where Fred was going with this, was just so that we could all talk and just kind of throw me in.
Should you take Royce first or first? I don't know.
That's the question. Yeah. Royce or Jackie McMullen?
I'm throwing Arnovitz in there, too.
Oh yeah,
He's
good.
I'd put KA there. That's for sure.
So that's our top five.
Is that
we've got a top five in the draft? Ramona.
It's in somebody that I just got to think of. Who am I? Who
Royce
am I?
Number one.
Royce one. Jackie McMullen two.
Who would you take number one for real?
I'd take Lee number one. I don't think anybody's better than Lee.
Yeah, he's so good.
He's really good.
He earned the number one pick with the LeBron back to Cleveland story.
Right, yeah. When he have you read Return of the King?
I'm sitting on my desk right now.
No, I heard it was great though. I heard it was really good.
It's very informative.
I heard it was great.
Like Lee Jenkins told basically, come to Las Vegas. We can't tell you why, just come to Las Vegas.
Right.
And he's like hanging around Las Vegas and trying to kind of hide who he is in case someone notices him. He's like real paranoid. And I don't know. They did a great job kind of telling that whole story. It's really good.
Like, I know we're getting off the rails here, but to me that like speaks to the respect that like Lee has earned from so many different people around the league. And a lot of people are always like, and myself included, it's like, it's almost unfair. The access Lee gets because like, you know, his features are so great because he's handed access that a lot of other people don't necessarily get, but that's the respect that he's earned. I mean, like for the same reason that LeBron James and Maverick Carter and Rich Paul or whoever thought to like, let's use Lee for this. It's like, because Lee has that level of respect from them.
Lee is the human human Players Tribune in that story.
Yeah, where's Dion Waiters going this?
That was the greatest article ever written.
Here's my favorite thing about that, Fred, is Dion Waiters is still retweeting people talking about it.
I love it.
Of course he is. He's and he's still shirtless doing it. While he's doing
2 months later.
It was so good, though. That was no, not hyperbole. That was the greatest Players Tribune article by far I have ever read in my entire life.
It was all over the place in the most glorious way. Like whoever ghost wrote it, or if Dion wrote it, or whoever, whatever happened with that thing. But like the tone and the voice was captured perfectly. It was wonderful.
It was great. It was funny. It was extremely honest. It was personal. It was like it completely captured it. I mean, we all know how funny that guy is. I mean, he is so funny, and he is such a good interview. He's great to media. He's great to cover. He's got this reputation of being a jerk, but he's not. He's great to he's great to media. He's fantastic to cover. Like he's so helpful, and he's always there. And like he's I think everyone who covers him, at least in Oklahoma City, everyone who covered him loved covering that guy.
How sad was Sam Presti to have to let him go?
He was sad to let him go.
I imagine.
The Thunder liked him, like personally. Like I'm not necessarily talking about basketball. Like they personally liked him a lot, which was a big change from Cleveland, because Cleveland did not like him. And I know there were a lot of people in Syracuse who did not like him, like really didn't like him either. And I don't know if he changed a lot from when he was young, but the Thunder, like everyone at the Thunder actively really liked him.
Well, it was, you know, a lot of it, Fred, is that, you know, the Thunder were so invested in him because I think that they, you know, Presti and Troy Weaver and Billy and a lot of people felt a lot, a pretty good sense of pride that they kind of helped rehabilitate Dion Waiters in a way, you know, like in, you know, the Dion Waiters, you know, a lot of the jokes about his hand up and calling for the ball and all that stuff was kind of going away when all of a sudden it's like Dion Waiters is buying into a role and playing hard-nosed defense and he's tough and he's competitive. And then you had all the stuff off the court and the personal tragedies that Dion went through, and he was kind of with the team, and the team saw him in the, you know, really vulnerable moments. And I think that, yeah, I think they absolutely felt a strong connection and investment in Dion, and you know they wanted him back. And you know, if Kevin Durant would have decided to stay in Oklahoma City, Dion Waiters would have been back.
I think it's the
main reason I'm mad at KD. Number one reason.
That's Dion right away there. From me.
Took Dion away.
Dion wouldn't have been here, Andrew, or Dion would have been here, and no, and Samaje Christian would not have been here. So.
See, Kevin.
I think it's interesting that when you ask Billy Donovan about Dion Waiters, the first thing he says every single time is how good of a father he thinks he is. I always find it very genuine and like a really nice thing to say about someone.
Yeah. Oh man, that would be we have three fathers here, and that's like the best compliment. I think either somebody's telling you that they think you're a great husband or a great father is like the best compliment you can be given.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just like a jerk single guy.
Or a great feature writer, you know, but you guys are just joking.
You're a great podcaster, Fred.
Yeah, there we Fred. Go. There we go. Thanks, guys. Thanks for coming on. Always. It's honestly just because I have great guests.
Yeah.
Are these finals
now,
boring?
Now you're just
by
being humble, deflecting. Yeah, just got to give it up to my teammates. You know, it's just my teammates.
So I got to read something to you guys, which is crazy. I got this ESPN press release today, and I couldn't believe it. I'm going to paraphrase this. The 2017 NBA Finals on ABC is the most watched since 1998 through two games, according to information from Nielsen. And it's up 5% through two games from last year. Game two is the highest rated game two in the finals since 1998, and it was up 13% from game two in 2016. Is that, Andrew, on a scale of 1 to 10, how shocked are you?
How shocked am I? I'm not that shocked. I know the NBA is just growing and growing, and there's all these superstars. People are interested. I don't know how many people are like watching the game to like break it down or like for the excitement, but I mean, I'm interested. I think I know what's going to happen. I think the Warriors are going to crush the Cavs in four games, but I'm interested to know what's going to happen just because there's a lot of faces that you know. But I wonder if they do crush them in four games and it's a margin of 15 points a game. What does that carryover look like to next year? Because I think this year it's going to keep even ramping up throughout the series because you just want to see, oh, can LeBron even get one? But I think that we'll know the answer for next year's finals. And what are the ratings look then is kind of my thought when I see that.
Next year when it's Warriors Cavs again.
Yeah, when we see Warriors Cavs part four, and we know that there's only one team competing for a championship next season, unless there's something crazy that happens in the offseason.
And the Cavs have Carmelo Anthony and Chris Paul on the team now.
Right.
Yeah.
The way it's going. I kind of want to see the ratings by quarter.
Yeah.
Yeah, the fourth quarter cannot be good.
Can't be good.
So they've got like peak throughout this. Where is this? It's in this release somewhere. It's on here somewhere. It peaked from no guys. I'm totally unprepared. Let me find this. Oh, here we go. The broadcast during game two peaked at a little over 23 million viewers from 10 to 10:30 p.m. Eastern time. So the game was at 8 Eastern time. 10 to 10:30 is like end of the
That's
third,
like
start
late
of the
second
fourth
half, isn't it?
That's like end of third, start of the fourth. Like they maybe even later. Like the game was that might be just the fourth quarter alone. Like the game ended at like 10:45.
Do these numbers, does that include like, is that separate of people streaming it? Or is that do these numbers like include that?
I believe that's separate of streaming, right? Nielsen
oh, really?
Is just
wow. That means a lot of people watched it.
Isn't Nielsen just television boxes? I could be wrong.
I want to say you're right, but I also wonder, like, did 10 million people tune in to start of the fourth quarter and saw the score and, you know, they peaked?
And then fall asleep on the couch with their TV on?
Right.
Yeah, how many people were doing what I was doing, walking in and out of the room while it was on? Like, not really watching it.
Towel over their head like Steph Curry and just went to... Just took it.
But, I mean, you know, Royce, you and I had tweets that said kind of basically the same thing. And Barry Trammell wrote about this kind of on the side as well. I mean, as long as people are tuning in and ratings are going up, I mean, and this is what the NBA wanted.
Mm-hmm.
The NBA could have curbed the cap spike. And I mean, Zach Lowe had wrote at one time that it was basically kind of minimal effort put forth by the league. Sort of like, hey, you want to do this? Players said no. They said, okay. But they've set this in motion. And you know, I know, you know, Andrew, you dedicated your pod Friday to Kevin Durant ruin the NBA. I actually kind of defended Kevin Durant on my radio show Saturday a little bit. It's the owners. It's the league. It's the players and the owners.
Yeah, Kevin had the – yeah, he was presented the opportunity to. I mean, you know, I think that it's like – I kind of wonder, John, you know, like, you know, the irony, you know, Lee Jenkins obviously wrote about this too, that is that, you know, LeBron being – you know, he's vice president, right, of the players union. And
right.
I think kind of some irony there is that, you know, he was part of this, you know, that LeBron is now a victim of, you know, what he helped set in motion. But I think the league itself and the reason that they didn't really push back too much on it. And I think the reason even LeBron or whoever, you know, people that really didn't push much back on the cap spike is they just didn't think Kevin Durant was going to go to the Warriors. I mean, I think that's what it really comes down to. You know, if Kevin Durant goes anywhere else, the balance of power in the NBA does not shift that severely. If he goes to Boston, if he goes to Miami, if he goes to even San Antonio, it doesn't shift in such a dramatic way that it did with Durant joining the 73-win Warriors. So, I mean, like the unique circumstances that happened here, you know, that's really what it's all about. And, you know, I agree. It's the owners and it's the league itself that didn't have the foresight to at least kind of put in parameters to prevent this from happening. Because I think the most striking, stunning thing to think about is that there were only three legitimate teams that otherwise would have had the ability to take Kevin Durant into their cap space. And that was the Heat, the Celtics, and the Rockets.
The Rockets.
So, like, if you've got even, you know, remove the fact, you know, every Thunder fan out there listening to this, take your Thunder fan hat off. And don't think, well, oh, you know, we would have been able to get them instead of them. It has nothing to do with that. But if you just that's standard NBA free agency right there. That's how it's supposed to work. But instead, the fact that 28 teams were able to absorb Kevin Durant into their cap space is staggering. And the fact that one of them was a team that just won 73 games and would have had a title if Draymond Green didn't go around punching people in the balls. like that to me is like that is a fundamental breakdown of the system. And whether or not, you know, the, you know, Silver and the NBA, you know, they probably just didn't think Durant would choose that path because nobody really thought Durant would choose that path. But the fact that they didn't have the foresight to prevent it is really short-sighted and a huge mistake.
Competitive balance is dead for like 4 years, right?
Yeah.
How long do you think this will go on?
I mean, look at – I think the Heat are a good example of this. I mean, people looked at when LeBron, you know, joined Wade and Bosch in Miami. A lot of people thought like, oh, my goodness, you know, this is going to be a 10-year – I mean, LeBron even, you know, not one, not two, not three. Mm-hmm. But you know, this is going to be 10 years of the Miami Heat just ruling the NBA. Like, what's the point of this anymore? I mean, things do happen. Things break up. You look at even the 2012 Thunder. You know, they were built organically, but most people thought like, oh, my goodness, this team's going to rule the Western Conference for 15 years. The difference is for the Warriors is that they're making money hand over fist. They're about to open up a new arena. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know what their television deal is that they have right now, but, you know, they're about to get hit with some luxury tax decisions, and they're going to have to make some cuts on that roster. But we're talking about fringe cuts. Sean Livingston, Ian Clark, maybe Andre Iguodala. As long as they keep those four players together, they can interchange the parts. And I think the thing that, you know, it's going to come down to the Pat Riley disease of Moore. Is a player going to get sick of it? You know, I don't think Curry's going anywhere. Draymond's probably not going anywhere. Klay Thompson, you know, CJ McCollum's throwing out there. Klay Thompson does seem like the likely candidate to feel like, hey, I'm sick of getting only 11 shots a game here now. And I personally don't. I believe Kevin Durant's going to play somewhere else in his NBA career. I don't think that's going to be next year or even 2 years from now. He's going to play somewhere else. I'm pretty confident. But things happen quickly in the NBA, but I think over the next 3 or 4 years, this is the way it's going to look like, unless, you know, there's an injury or something wild happens.
I have a question.
Just go look at.
Go ahead, Em.
Just go look at Bobby Marks's feed at Bobby Marks 42 from the Vertical. And look at the luxury tax bills the Warriors are going to rack up when the repeater tax kicks in. I mean, he's estimating 72 million, then 110, then 283, then 260. That's when it's going to start. You're going to have the Miami effect, where Miami let go of Mike Miller and it started kind of, you know, crumbling the Miami thing. Something like that could happen there as well over the next few years.
Okay, so I have a question for John, because like you. Out of the four of us here, you know the most about the business side of the NBA. So I have a question for you. Something okay. You brought up, Royce brought up, a million people have brought it up, is the cap smoothing. How the NBA should have, or at the very least could have, had the foresight to smooth the cap or push the players' union harder on smoothing the cap and not just taking a nah, no thanks, and then moving on approach like they did in terms of, you know, not wanting to smooth the cap and allowing for that 20-some-odd million-dollar cap spike from 1 year to the next. For the listeners who are unaware of what smoothing the cap is, that's basically making it so there's an incremental rise in the cap that's more natural, as opposed to going from a 60-something million-dollar cap or $70 million cap up to a cap in the 90s over the course of one offseason, like what happened last year, which allowed for a team to have the cap space to sign a guy like Durant when they were already a 73-win team. My question is, how come that's as far back as people are willing to go? And if why even leave it up to the players' union? If you're going to make a criticism of the NBA, isn't the criticism of the NBA and the structuring of this TV deal to begin with, couldn't they have just structured the money? The total money could have been exactly the same, and I get that you want the money coming in as a dollar today is more valuable than a dollar tomorrow. That's economics 101. But couldn't they have structured the income differently in this deal, even if the total dollars were the same, or maybe you find some way to make it even so it's distributed differently, just so if the income is different, if the revenue that you're bringing in from this TV deal is different than it is right now, if it's structured differently, then you don't even have to worry about going to the MBPA about a cap spike, because there is no cap spike. You don't have to worry about smoothing because the money is coming in more incrementally. Why is that not a thing that's addressed more? And I'll just ask you, why is that not a thing that's addressed more?
I remember that being a topic. Whether they would structure the TV deal like that, because they were looking for ways to keep from having a giant one-year leap. And if you want to go back even further, let's go back to 2011. And just to kind of take people way inside baseball that you really don't care about probably, but like in that collective bargaining agreement, they put in like hard numbers. Like, here's what we think basketball-related income is going to be this year and this year and this year. And then there was a formula that if it's more than that or less than that, you know, then they divvy up the money appropriately. And they put woefully low numbers in there for 2016-17. So that didn't help matters. Putting hard numbers in rather than using some percentages that might have helped curb some of this. But either one of those, yeah, if you go back further, either one of those certainly could have helped at this point.
You guys want to talk about Russell Westbrook for a little bit?
Okay.
It's a Thunder podcast. Yes. It's a Thunder podcast.
Well, and, I thought we were going to talk about the Harden trade. But
I don't want to be sad anymore, Fred.
Andrew, how was Andrew, what did you think of the Harden trade? Good deal?
Let's break it down. You guys got 45 minutes?
Yeah.
Let's talk Harden trade.
Okay. This is a topic that, and Andrew, you texted this to me. It's a good one. I can't find it in my text details now. Why don't you just pose the question to yourself and then start talking about it?
Okay. So there's talk about Russell Westbrook he's supposedly going to play differently, or else he needs to play differently next season, which I agree. I think for this team to have any success next season, he's going to have to share the ball a little bit more. I think he has teammates that can do a little bit more than they showed this season. So the question is, what does he need to do differently? And how is that going to happen? Does he need new teammates? Is this just a function of coaching? Is this Russ accepting something new? Everybody talks about Russ will be different next season, but how exactly is he going to be different next season?
He's got to get off the ball. I mean, he's just got to get off the ball some. I think that, you know, if you watch a good contrast is a little bit in the way the Rockets play with Harden, you know, in the way the Thunder play with Westbrook, because if you look at like a lot of their numbers and the tracking numbers, they're very similar in terms of like time of possession with the ball, dribbles per touch, isolation opportunities. I mean, there's a lot of things that are similar, but like stylistically, if you watch the Thunder and the Rockets play, there is a significant difference there. Now, obviously Harden has much different personnel that's kind of been tailored to fit what he needs. The Rockets have had a number of years to kind of figure out what fits with Harden and what doesn't. The Thunder had, you know, no time really at all to sort out what's going to work with Westbrook. And they've already started to kind of, you know, re-engineer the team to fit to the way they think that Westbrook plays. But if you watch like a Westbrook possession, it's going to start and it's going to end with him in some regard almost at all times. Even if there's great ball movement in a Thunder possession, the ball almost always finds its way to Russell Westbrook, and he's the one making the final decision. At least it feels that way the majority of the time. So Westbrook is a guy that's going to – if he gives it up, he's going to get it back, and then he's going to attack. And I think the Thunder need to develop – or Westbrook really kind of needs to develop more of a mentality to get off the ball and let it move organically around you know, and then, you know, trust that he's going to get it back, not necessarily going to hunt it back, because I think that's what Westbrook has a bad habit of, is that he kind of goes and hunts the ball back down, and that he's not a guy that really ever lets a pass lead to a pass that leads to a basket. He's a guy that almost, you know, I've written this about Russell before, is that in a way he kind of selfishly hunts assists, because he will, and this is where a lot of his turnovers come from, is that he wants to directly have a pass that leads to a basket. Like, he wants a pass that's going to end up in somebody's hands and they're going to be able to get a layup. And that's one of Westbrook's best qualities, because he's able to, you know, engineer layups and dunks for a lot of different players based on that stuff. But I think that Westbrook's got to just peel back a little bit more. I mean, I think the perfect example of this, and this is something that I myself am kind of trying to work on to figure out as I watch the finals, but like, I mean, just kind of watch how LeBron plays it. Like, LeBron, like, lets the Cavalier offense flow a little more organically. And I think that part of that is because of the personnel. You got a guy like Kyrie Irving that can isolate, and you can just put the ball in his hands. It gets LeBron off of it and creates a little more diversity. And, you know, I guess that's some of it is you got to ask Victor Oladipo. You got to ask some of these other guys to do more than they're doing.
John, give me something here.
Say words.
Okay, how far can this team go? And I've got a caveat to add at the end of this. How far can this team go with Russell Westbrook as concerned about his stats as he is, with the caveat that many an NBA player is concerned about their stats?
Maybe this is just me just speculating, or just, I don't know. But don't you think he'll be less concerned with the next season?
I have said many times, I kind of felt like this season kind of like was the perfect storm for this to happen.
Right.
The triple-double chase to happen. But yeah, because just you had a bunch of young players, and then you had the Durant drama, and then you had Russ coming out of it. And, you know, there was a number of reasons why I could see that coming to be. But it just feels like this team's ceiling is awfully low as long as he's really, you know, paying attention to that stuff. And again, I throw in the caveat that a lot of the NBA players are very stat conscious.
Yeah, I don't know. I think some of it is also him trusting the guys that are around him. He's got so many guys that are 25 and younger around him, but he's got guys that can do stuff with the ball. Like, we know Steven Adams is a decent passer. Sabonis can pass the ball a little bit. I think Oladipo can do a lot more than what he was asked to do. But Westbrook has never really done stuff off the ball. I wrote a piece for Vantage Sports. It was the last year with Durant, and I tracked Curry and Westbrook's screens, their off-ball screens, and Curry had set like almost 700 screens by March that season. Westbrook set like 70, and most of them were probably by accident or like recorded incorrectly.
He's a horrible screener. I think Fred and I have talked about this before, how bad a screener Westbrook is.
Yeah, but he doesn't – it's not even – there's just not even an attempt to do it. And I think that's one of the most underrated things about Stephen Curry is that you just see him and you think, oh, there's no way that he sets screens all the time. Chris very Paul, effective yeah. ones too.
Chris Paul is an incredible screen setter.
Yeah.
That's what people don't realize about player movement. Like, a lot of people think that you're setting a screen to get somebody else open. A lot of times, you know, if you talk to a basketball coach, they'll tell you set a screen to get yourself open. Mm-hmm. Like, that's the way you generate a lot of that different type of stuff. And, you know, a lot of people will say, well, that's Billy Donovan's got to do that. Well, no, it's really Russell Westbrook. I can promise you right now that Billy Donovan is a smart enough basketball coach that understands these aspects, but it's a matter of like generating that type of stuff. Russell Westbrook, for as wonderful as he is, it's like, it's one of those things where it's like, you got to lay, like John Hamm just did, you got to lay the caveat out there. He's wonderful. He's an incredible basketball player, one of the five best in the world. But like, you know, he really just kind of standing around waiting to get the ball back. That's really just kind of how he plays.
I have a follow-up to Royce on this, and it's kind of taking a different direction. How much of this falls on the Thunder? Because if you look at – and not just on Russ, because, and I realize that they're intrinsically tied together, of course, and we're assuming obviously he's going to be there next year to make all of this true. But so let's say, for example, in San Antonio, and I realize that – what happens in San Antonio is not attainable for the other 29 organizations because it's the Spurs. And saying, why aren't you like the Spurs is a ridiculous thing. But just hear me out in the culture thing for a second. One of the reasons that the Spurs are set up the way they are is because Tim Duncan could take a tongue lashing from Greg Popovich. And because Pop can go up to Kawhi and he can yell at him, and Kawhi can say to them, and Pop can say, you know, in a media scrum that Kawhi didn't play good defense one day or didn't run their sets the right way. And he could do that with, because he could do that with Tim Duncan, everyone falls in line. And it's a similar thing with Bill Belichick and Tom Brady, right? Bill Belichick can yell at Tom Brady and call him out. So it's like, well, if he's doing that to Tom Brady, he can do that to anybody. And the Thunder, in a lot of ways, Royce, as you know, as all you guys know, they handle Russell Westbrook with you know, baby gloves. Baby gloves mm-hmm. is that the term, kid gloves. They do that in a...
Kid glove,
in a lot of ways. I mean, they don't like calling him out for his pick and roll defense. That's just like a thing that often doesn't really get addressed, and it's something that I know they've wondered, like, how can we handle the pick and roll defense? Because a lot of it is not just he handles a heavy load on offense, and so he has to rest on defense. A lot of it is just like seriously a problem for the team, and it's something they struggle to figure out how to address. So if they struggle to figure out how to address that kind of stuff, isn't it going to be tough for them to address other sorts of things as well? If this is Russell's in his basketball DNA, it's his habit, it's the way that he wants to play, it's the way that he feels most comfortable playing. Isn't it going to be tough for them to address that sort of stuff if they can't address the smaller things too? Royce, is that too harsh of a question?
No, I don't think it's a harsh question. I just think, you know, if we talk in terms of reality with Russell Westbrook and the way the Thunder have always been, it's just – it's hard to imagine. I mean, this is Westbrook's franchise, and you know they know Russell better than anybody else, and that's one of the reasons that they treated him the way they did when he was younger. Is they knew kind of his sensitivities, and they kind of insulated him, and you know tried to kind of help him get through a lot of the criticisms, because you know they essentially just enabled the guy to the highest degree, both on the court and off the court. And they've, you know, you look at the way that they've handled, you know, media policy, not to interject ourselves into it, but it's not like anybody's sitting down with Russell Westbrook and saying, hey, could you be a little nicer? You know, like it's just, it's, you know, Russell is an individual and they let him operate as he does, because the Thunder are a players first organization and they cater to their players. And, you know, I think that it's one of those things where, you know, you can point the finger at Billy Donovan. I think Billy has a great relationship with Russell. But you know, they've only been together now 2 years, and I don't know that, you know, I've been told by people that Billy is, you know, pretty hard on players in the film room, and Russell's as hard as on himself as anybody else. And that's one of the things people have said about Westbrook, is there's no reason to really get on the guy because he's getting on himself all the time. But you know, the question is, Fred, is like, do you see the difference that happened on the court? And I think Russell is a guy that is often been a, you know, he can say it, and he can say it till he's blue in the face, and you might believe that he's saying it, but even he himself is his worst enemy to walk on the floor and still not do the thing. You know, like, he can say, don't take 9 threes in a game. I remember Russell saying that, was that maybe last year? Might have been 2 years ago, where he was like, I'm taking too many threes. I got to quit taking threes. And, you know, what does he do? 2 weeks later, he's taking 12 in a game. So, I mean, like, I think it's one of those things with Westbrook. He's an incredibly intelligent guy, but, you know, one of the battles that he always fights is that he believes in himself more than anybody else in the entire world. And he just gets this like overwhelming tunnel vision of like, just, he reminds me of like my dad. Like when, like, I remember my dad one time was like helping me, like wanted to teach me how to like work on my truck one time when I was like 17, and like, I'm like doing everything wrong, you know? So instead of like, I'm like kind of messing with stuff and I'm doing it all wrong, and instead of just being like, just let him mess it up, you know, my dad like just grabs the wrench out of my hands, like, just let me do it. I think it's just Russell. I think he's like, yeah. Let me do it. Get out of the way.
So Russell is kind of like the hooded Kermit meme.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah. And I would say too, I mean, there is a difference. Obviously, I mean, the Thunder have never been an organization to, you know, come out and call out their own players in public. So we have no idea what exactly goes on behind the scenes. So, I mean, I would just throw that caveat out there. Like, you know, San Antonio and New England, they just operate a little bit differently publicly, whereas behind the scenes, maybe there's a bit more accountability than what maybe people are seeing whenever they get in and do a press conference.
Like, one of my favorite things favorite coach quotes that I can ever remember was last year when Brady was coming back after his 4-game suspension, and somebody asked, you know, Belichick, like, jokingly. They were like, so Brady going to start this week? And like Belichick, you know, he might have been joking back because, you know, it's hard to tell with the guy. But like his response was like, well, we got to see how he practices this week. And it's like, me, like, I don't know if Belichick was actually joking because, you know, he's incredibly dry or whatever. But like, to me, like, just the messaging there is so straightforward and simple of like, I don't know, we'll see how he practices. Like, you know, that to me, that's just that is like your culture defined right there. And it's funny you mentioned that, John, that like calling out player. I feel like I can only remember one coach or one player ever getting called out by a coach. And that was Scott Brooks calling out Reggie Jackson. And that's that's like really the only time I can ever remember it. Like, you know, there's been times a player's maybe kind of said the player's got to do this a little better, or this a little. Like, I remember Scott Brooks called out Reggie Jackson one time for his defense, and like, that's the only time I can ever remember that happening.
And I remember Sam Presti being disappointed in Mitch McGarry.
Yes.
Aren't we all had our turn with that.
Aren't we all?
So, we have a very small sample. We have one season of Westbrook being the leader of a team. Like, how much is he going to change? Is it going to take his teammates being better? Like, what's it going to take for this team to make another step?
Yeah, I think it's all on the teammates. Like, because, you know, I think, Fred, you might have pointed this out during the playoffs, that when you saw those Abrines-McDermott lineups, as limited as they were, but, you know, Westbrook, I thought, especially too, like, he looked for those guys. And Westbrook played differently with that kind of personnel on the floor. And, like, you know, there were times, and I think, you know, fourth quarter is going to be a different territory, you know, game in a close game in the final 5 minutes. Westbrook is just always going to, you know, it's going to be hard for him to cede control at those points. It's always been a challenge, especially last year. But I think when you get the right personnel on the floor with Westbrook, I mean, he's a smart guy. So, like, I think that, you know, he's willing to utilize. But when you've got the specialists on the floor, when you're playing Andre Roberson and Jeremy Grant out there with them, or even, you know, Steven Adams and Domantas Sabonis, like, you know, I think Westbrook's like sitting there going, like, what the hell am I supposed to do, guys? Like, what do you want me to do? But you know, you get a Breanis, you get McDermott, you get some offensively talented players out there that can do a few different things with the ball in their hand. And I think Westbrook is more apt, to your point, Andrew, I think he's more apt to trust in those guys, especially next year. And that'll be an interesting thing to watch, is if that does carry through.
It will.
Yeah,
be
I think they need to reshape the roster.
Yeah, well, I agree things need to be reshaped, but like Andrew, a lot of this stuff was self-inflicted, right? Like they didn't need to be last in 3-point percentage. Like they could have played Alex Abrines more than 15 minutes a game. Alex Abrines was not their 11th best player this year. We can debate whether he was their 7th best or 8th best or whatever it was, but like Alex Abrines deserved to play more than 15 minutes a game on a team that was dead last in the NBA in 3-point percentage when he was shooting 42% after Christmas from 3. You know, he deserved to get playing time, and he made a difference. He's going to have some games where he doesn't make shots, but at least guys guard him. Like McDermott was going to have some games where he didn't make shots, where at least guys guard him. I think if you play some offensive weapons around, of course they need some more help. Of course they need a backup point guard. Of course they could use another couple of shooters on the wing. Like, of course those things are true. But there are certain things that are fixable internally right away, and considering the cap situation that they're in, those are probably the most realistic ways for them to make massive strides for next year, is along with obviously, you know, improvement and the guys like Abrines and McDermott and Grant who are young and presumably will get better with another year.
You know why they were dead last in the NBA in 3-point shooting though?
Because
Andre Robertson took 184 of them.
Yes. Oh.
Andre Robertson played. Took the fourth most threes on the team. Like I don't know. I can't do the math quickly off the top of my head, but just like cut those in half. Just cut that in half. And like I think that's part of like, you know, Presti's talked about this and Billy Donovan's talked about being a more intelligent, smarter team. You know, whether Robertson's back or not, I think, you know, the team would be in a better place if Robertson is back, just in a very practical standpoint. But like you gotta be smarter you gotta make smarter decisions. And like Andre Robertson cranking out 5 threes a game is not smart, you know? So I think that's where it's at. And even that's where Westbrook's evolution can be, is that like redistributing those low percentage shots into higher percentage places. And so like, you know, a long pull up two from Westbrook with 14 on the shot clock, not a high efficiency look. So if you can redistribute that to where the ball moves 1, 2, maybe 3 more times, and it ends up with even a Jeremy Grant corner three or a Doug McDermott wing three, those are high efficiency. That's like redistributing your efficiency. And I think that's where the Thunder got to improve, Westbrook specifically.
Yeah, no doubt. And they played Samaj Christian off the ball. Off the ball.
It all comes back to Samaj.
I mean, it does, because you had Alex Abrines on the team. He was still on the team. He was still there. I mean, there were some weird – Billy made some weird decisions. Yeah. And if Kyle Singler is back, are they going to try to – pretend that he's an NBA player again? Like they do these strange things where they like try to cycle through the roster, try to figure out who's who. Like, can we just all show up and just say like we know who's who on this particular roster? We know Kyle Singler and Samaj Christian can't shoot, and that they're barely NBA players. Like, we know that.
The one guy we don't know is Josh Eustis, because I'm still a believer. Agreed. I'm a Eustis truther.
I'm on the train, man. I agree. I think he needs to play.
I won't allow Royce.
Things about the team is that they didn't figure out how good Josh Eustis was last year.
Royce, I will not allow positive talk about Josh Eustis on this podcast.
I'm just saying that, like, if we talk about, I mean, if Domantas Sabonis is Chris Bosh, Josh Eustis is at least.
Hey, Royce, I had my Chicken Express guy when he emailed me the new special for the month. He said, and by the way, I can't believe Royce Young thinks that.
Chris, this is me banging my desk. Do you hear it? I'm banging my desk.
The bonus is Chris Bosh. I've never been so happy to see an email.
That is fantastic. I actually do agree with you, though, Bryce. Like, I don't understand why you draft a guy in the first round and then not play him.
Especially this past season.
Right, exactly, John. In this quote-unquote season of discovery, they didn't discover anything about Josh Eustis.
Yeah. In Josh Eustis's very limited minutes, he's been like good. He has a 26 PER in his 31 minutes last season.
That's sustainable.
Yeah, it's so totally sustainable. No, but it's not like he comes in and he's like an embarrassment. He comes in and he's like, oh, well, that looks like an NBA wing to me, and then he's just gone.
He's what, the third best athlete on the team? Maybe the second best? It's him, yeah. Jeremy Grant, and Russell Westbrook are the three best athletes on the team, right?
I mean, it's the type of thing, though. And that, you know, like, again, I think if you ask anybody in the Thunder, they want Andre Roberson back, you know, but it's going to be at a price. And, you know, the Thunder are going to draw their line in the sand. I don't know how good Josh Huestis actually may be. But, you know, it's one of those types of things. Sometimes you got to remove something to find out how good you have it. And so, like, if Andre Roberson ends up somewhere else and Josh Huestis is getting 24 minutes a game, Thunder might find out they got a really good player there, and it might not be such a bad thing. So, like, it's about opportunity. And, you know, I think that a lot of people can just assume that Josh Huestis isn't good because he's been in the D League and he hasn't played so much. But, like, it's hard to really figure out, like, why? Why do you think he's not good? Because athletically, intelligently – I mean, he can shoot. He can do a lot of different things. And it's a big mistake they made last year, not kind of finding out. And I think it's something that they probably will try to do a lot better at this upcoming season.
The shooting is weird. He shot 37-38% from three this year. Like, the whole thing was that he couldn't shoot. But he's 37-38% from three in the G League this year.
Right. On a team supposedly devoid of shooting and looking for two-way players. I mean, Huestis came in the league as – you know, a guy that, like, quote unquote, was a great defensive player that was going to need to learn how to shoot. You know, which is the same book on Andre Roberson. Now, Huestis is not the level of a defender Roberson is at all. But, like, you know, if we're splitting hairs here, like, you know, Huestis is far more in the vein of the two-way player than Andre Roberson is.
What's interesting about the Huestis situation is that the Thunder are kind of in a lose-lose now. Because let's say they cut him and he never plays in the NBA ever again. That's all of a sudden a horrible first round pick because they took that gamble on him because he was going to go to the D League for a year, and they gambled on their own internal player development on a guy whose draft stock was second round at best. And then he ended up playing single digit games with the Thunder when they could have had a first round pick there. You know, maybe he goes to another team and contributes. Well, then they look even worse because they give up on him and got nothing. Even if he comes in this year, though, and does something, from a PR perspective, obviously, you know, it's not an unsalvageable pick or anything like that. It's not like 2 years ruined the pick. From a PR perspective, the first question anybody's going to ask is, wait a second, he looked pretty good as a rookie. He looked pretty good in 2016-17. Why the heck didn't he get a chance? What happened? Why didn't he get a chance? Why are you playing, you know, player X amount of minutes when Huestis could have been playing? So they're kind of at a point where, not that you should necessarily operate or make any decisions as a team based on what the PR is going to be, but there's going to be a PR backlash no matter what his future is now, whether he becomes a guy who literally never plays another second in the NBA or whether he becomes LeBron James. There's going to be a PR backlash in some direction because of the way they've handled it.
They've mangled it. They've mismanaged that situation severely.
Mm-hmm. He's played fewer NBA minutes than Walter Tavares.
That doesn't seem right. That seems bad.
Well, I look at the draft and I look like a guy like Semi Ojeleye out of SMU, and I'm just like, he's a big guy. He can shoot the ball. He can defend a little bit. He's a low usage player. And I'm like, if the Thunder draft him, are they going to play him over Josh Huestis? Because he sounds an awful lot like Josh Huestis to me.
Right.
Huestis is not as ripped as Semi is, but I don't know. It's a very confusing.
That's why I think in, you know, to jump ahead to the draft, I think that's why it whoever they decide to go with will be pretty revealing in terms of, you know, the way that they see the roster construction. You know, what I think that'll be kind of an interesting tell on what they think is coming next.
Who are they drafting, Bryce? You got your inside info there. You know, the first 21 picks are going to be.
I'll tell you, like, June 23rd who they're drafting.
Yeah.
When is the draft? June 22nd? I don't know what it is.
It is June 22nd.
It is the 22nd.
So I can definitely tell you on the 23rd.
All right, guys. Is this all we got?
I believe so.
What a sad moment. It's when we come to an end.
We got to save some stuff for next time.
It's a depressing. This is the moment, John, where we break away.
Yes.
Take a chance. Settle down.
I'm not worried. Did you set aside 20 minutes for us to plug all of our stuff, Fred?
Yeah. Plug it. Plug it.
I was just joking.
No, plug it. This is the Imodium Hour. Plug it up. Do it.
Oh.
All right. Dumped on Thunder is dumping up.
the Dumped On Network. Listen to Down to Dunk if you don't already do it. Also, we're having a draft. Down to Dump, we're having a draft party on the 22nd at Anthem Brewing from 6 to 9. So come check that out.
Ham.
Listen to the franchise, but only when I'm on.
Sports Animals better listen to it when I'm on.
We have a battle.
Roya, you got anything coming out?
Not for a couple weeks.
Wow, look at you. Some nice time until the draft.
It's like people are into the finals or something.
Yeah, you can follow Royce. He's the new Woj. He's breaking draft info every single day once the draft is over.
Man, so yeah.
you can follow him. Woj is tweeting out the picks like minutes before they're made. And
Tweet them out minutes after.
Royce is tweeting them out days after they're made.
Days after.
On like August 23rd, you're going to be able to see who was the pick.
That's right. You're breaking news, guys. You're Eric Maynor has a torn ACL.
Yeah, you're like you're like Karen in Mean Girls, who's able to tell the weather once it's already raining.
Yes.
Yeah. All right, guys. Well, I'm on every Tuesday, Thursday. I'm back on Thursday. That's, I guess, how Tuesdays and Thursdays work. I'm going back to more times a week. I'll probably make an announcement on what the actual schedule is going to be either on Thursday's episode or on the episode a week from today on Tuesday. You can head on to iTunes to subscribe to Locked On Thunder. Questions, comments, email lockedonthunder@gmail.com or find me on Twitter at Fred Katz. You can find Andrew at Andrew K. Schlecht, right?
That's it.
John M. Hamm and just at Royce Young. You can log onto normantranscript.com for all your Thunder needs, and you can check out Thunder Road to follow team coverage and what's next for the Thunder there. That's going to do it for today. Thanks to all you guys for coming on. This is a fun couple podcasts that we did.
Yeah, good stuff.
Well, until Thursday, Locked On Thunder is locking up.
Bruno Caboclo has more minutes than Josh Eustace.